Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Toby Miller, Professor of Cultural Industries at the City University of London, and recently the director of the UC Studies Center in Mexico City and chair of the Department of Media and Cultural Studies at the University of California, Riverside. Toby Miller is one of the world's leading analysts of popular culture, media, and their connection to the politics of everyday life. His books include Cultural Citizenship, How Conservatives and Neoliberals Capture the Cultural Politics of Television and How We Can Take It Back, Greening the Media, and Blow Up the Humanities. His latest article at the City University of London's website is The Race for the White House 2012, The New American Dream. Welcome to Background Briefing, Toby Miller.
Thanks very much, Ian. Good to be with you.
And your article sort of got me thinking about this great irony here in the United States, where the wealth-producing and knowledge-generating centers in the blue states of the country, like New York and California, that vote Democrat, subsidize Republican right-wing welfare in socialist red states who vote Republican. And you were just down in Mexico City there during the election, and you saw how the pre-party used their patronage system in giving out, you know, free cards to people to shop at the shopping chain owned by a pre-supporter, etc. How different is the Mexican pre-party's patronage system from, say, the Republican Party's patronage system?
Well, it's an interesting point you make, Ian, and a provocative one. The Partido Revolucionario Institucional, the Institutional Revolutionary Party in Mexico, for decades has followed a policy of what's sometimes called incorporation, sometimes called corporatism, which is to say that whenever it's seen forms of opposition from left or right, instead of simply trying to silence them by censoring them or defeating them, it sought to incorporate them into its method of ruling. And that's why, for example, you get very radical artists, poets, writers, and so on, who, to a certain extent, actually get subsidies to do their cultural work in Mexico, despite their politics, because the idea is better to have them inside the big tent than outside it. In the United States, historically, we had something like that, very controversially and in a complex and contradictory way, with the forms in which the government would subsidize an anti-Marxist left during the Cold War in the 50s and 60s. Certain intellectuals who were opposed to Marxism, but sometimes opposed to U.S. imperialism, were nevertheless given hidden subsidies to go about their work. But it's never been as thoroughgoing a project in the U.S. However, what we do have, in my view, and not only mine, is a bizarre situation in which there is, to reuse an old phrase, socialism for the rich and capitalism for the poor, but more particularly, not necessarily always for wealthy people, a form of institutionalized state intervention into the economy in the United States in Republican strongholds, but in ways that make it look as though this is not about big government when in fact it is.
Well, just the other day, Chris Christie, the Republican governor of New Jersey, which of course bore the brunt of the recent storm Sandy, he praised the Army Corps of Engineers, which is a government organization, for building sand dunes to protect a certain part of New Jersey as opposed to the others that got wiped out, and made a case for government intervention, which, of course, is a heresy with the Republican Party. But you're arguing in your article at City University of London's website, The Race for the White House 2012, The New American Dream, that most southern and western states are full of people dependent upon land-grabbed wealth or the military, relying on the military and the government buying and subsidizing weapons, drugs, and minerals. Explain that form of right-wing welfare.
Right. Well, let's start with the military. Frequently, anti-statist rhetoric in the United States completely misses out the fact that the military is, in fact, just as much a part of the government as is Medicare, as is Medicaid, as is the Internal Revenue Service, and so on. Somehow or other, the military gets a free pass as if it were just an essence of the nation that had nothing to do with government. And of course, we have an enormous military, as everybody knows. It takes up about 42% roughly of the world's expenditure on the military. And vast amounts of that goes into parts of the country where it is a major employer. As I think most of your listeners will know, the military is the biggest employer of young people in the United States. And it isn't only a direct employer of those who work for the Pentagon or work for the different arms of the military. It also is a massive employer of all kinds of high-tech and low-tech companies, the vast majority of whose work goes only to one customer, and that is the government. So the idea that government is always inefficient, that it gets in the way, that it's un-American, that it's not part of everyday life, is patently absurd when you consider this massive role of the military. I mean, there are all kinds of companies, from cell phone firms to high-tech areas, that only survive and only thrive and, in many cases, only come into being as a consequence of this investment, and massive bases all over the country as well. Just pay testimony to that. In terms of the other part of the question, not necessarily about the military, but about land grabs, speculation, and so on, again, in many cases, not necessarily through the federal government, often through state or municipal governments, there's huge coordination, there always has been, between various speculative interests within big business and small business, in particular jurisdictions, and the making available of land or the invocation of eminent domain ideas and so on in order to facilitate that sort of money-making. We, of course, have seen a lot of it in California, if not more than in other states. Just think about the whole history of Chavez Ravine in Los Angeles. So, you know, the argument that get government out of the way, entrepreneurs just make up their own minds, do their own things, and then reach out and invest. And this is magical because they're in touch with the interests of the consumers and are constantly coming up with fresh ideas. As if this were done in a vacuum, away from the participation of government, is patently absurd.
Again, I'm speaking with Toby Miller, Professor of Cultural Industries at the City University of London. He was recently the director of the UC Studies Centre in Mexico City and chair of the Department of Media and Cultural Studies at the University of California, Riverside. His latest book is Greening the Media and Blow Up the Humanities, and he has an article at the City University of London's website, The Race for the White House 2012, The New American Dream. Again, Governor Christie of New Jersey, again was pointed out that New Jersey gives more money to the federal government than it gets back than any other state. It's a blue state, and that's quickly followed by New York and California. Conversely, the red states like Mississippi and Alabama and some of the Midwestern and Western states that are red are also in that category. And you've mentioned subsidies to those states via military bases and military patronage, but there's also the farm bill is a huge source of patronage. Every year, I've some friends in Idaho were just saying that every year, all these Republican white men are driving brand new pickup trucks thanks to the federal government when they get their checks, quite often for not growing crops.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this goes back a very, very long way. Obviously, there are all kinds of stories from the Great Depression of farmers being paid to destroy the land they were supposedly tilling. But the farm bill for years and years, ever since, has grown as a subsidy of corporate agriculture rather than small agriculture, as people imagine it to be. But it's done in such a way that it is sacrosanct because of the idea that you can trust a country man, a rural man, you can't trust a city man, and it's all very gendered, because of the notion of this fierce spirit of pioneering independence, autonomy, as you say, the, in a sense, mythology, the foundational mythology of the rapacious white man at the heart of American modernity. That mythology is immensely powerful. And, of course, there are very pragmatic lobbies, corporate lobbies in the agricultural sector, in Washington especially, that utilize that mythology as a means of ensuring that corporate welfare is handed out to them. So, yes, there's no doubt that's a major factor. And, you know, whenever we're in major negotiations with other countries or with international organizations about free trade, much of that debate hinges on whether or not the farm lobby, the internet lobby, the Hollywood lobby is in the ascendant when it comes to dealing with particular parts of the relevant administration. But the farm bill goes on and on and on in just as absurd and corrupt a way as its equivalent in the European Union over here where I currently am. Yet, because of this rugged, pioneering, masculinist ethos of farming, it's got a special sheath that protects it, very similar to the special sheath that protects massive expenditure on the military, which is, on the one hand, that, again, this is to reiterate what I said before, this is not big government, this is the nation, but B, the idea that, you know, the birth of the country was experienced through bloodshed, through the revolution, and that the United States has always been prepared to fight for its own freedom and the freedom of others, and that this is once more something that is, in a sense, outside the government, but inside the heart, the beating spirit of every American citizen. And with that mythology in place, it becomes just as hard to attack the military as it is hard to attack the farm lobby. Those who've tried have normally come off second best.
And Toby Miller, your article, The Race for the White House 2012, The New American Dream, at the City University of London's website, says that the nation, meaning the United States, recently became the first in the world with more than half of its people living in suburbia, a quarter of them minorities. This shift from rural to urban to suburban living sees middle-class people increasingly disarticulated from cultural differences, class conflict, and public transportation. They reside in quietly sectarian private worlds. So explain that and how that's going to impact the election in terms of this red-blue divide.
Well, one of the extraordinary things about the history of the U.S. is, of course, that in real terms, it made a shift from being an agrarian to an industrial or manufacturing, quite urban country in many ways, fairly quickly in the 19th century and especially in the 20th century. What's happened since is that rapid shift of millions of people from the countryside to the city has been succeeded by a shift to suburbia. And again, your California-based listeners will be extremely familiar with this. Just look around yourselves at Orange County, for example, and the way in which that now is a place, and there are plenty of examples right around the country, Atlanta would be another one, where it's not just the case that the suburbs are white flight, where middle-class white folks want to get away from the urban conflict of interracial experience. It's lots of other ethnic groups and racial groups that move as well. And that means that inevitably you also get all kinds of office and building construction out in those places. Again, Irvine and Atlanta would be good examples. But the problem is that as a consequence of the fact that this is principally a middle-class movement, it means that these people lead privatized lives very much in their car between their home and wherever they shop, and between those places and wherever they work, and don't encounter very often people who are different from them. And that one of the difficulties when you're talking about a massive multicultural nation like the U.S., with differences and conflicts that are partly about race and partly about age and partly about religion and partly about class, is that the warp and woof of everyday urban life, the requirement if you're in a big city like New York or Los Angeles or Chicago, that you simply encounter people who look and sound and act differently from you on a daily basis, is lost. Now, on the one hand, that can make people feel very comfortable. On the other, it can make them extremely intolerant because they're not used to simply rubbing shoulders and splitting apples and sinking beers with folks who are really different from them. And of course, one of the fault lines in the United States politically is over this question of difference, of sexual difference, of racial difference, of class difference, where for all their monstrosities, and you know, for what it's worth, I'm a registered independent, the Democrats are some kind of coalition of difference, and the Republicans are some kind of coalition against difference. The Republicans have all kinds of different groups that support them, but the Democrats have groups that are, in a sense, testament to all the varieties of the census, all those points of difference when it comes to religion and age and race and sexuality that I was talking about a moment ago. And right. So that's, I think, one of the key aspects. In addition, needless to say, the big cities tend to be Democratic strongholds because they are where people rub up against difference, they are where people are unionized, they are where people are educated, and they are where people have traveled and have seen difference at first hand and don't necessarily favor big states in terms of militarism and small states in terms of compassion.
Well, Toby Miller, we've only got a few minutes left. You also say in your article, Governor Romney favors slashing public expenditures on higher education. President Obama seeks minor increases. Polling indicates the general public wants to double the tertiary education budget and make monumental cuts to the Pentagon. Obama is as imperial a president as Romney aspires to be. Both are weak men, tools of the prevailing political economy. They are as vulnerable as they are imperial. So, pretty damning. I can see that you are an independent. I think one could make the case that the Republicans have made a wise investment in ignorance, and we will know on Tuesday or Wednesday whether that has paid off. Your basic message here is that America needs to invest in knowledge and disavow empire.
Oh, absolutely. I think that despite the ideological power of the myths that I talked about before, as I indicated, the opinion polls show that the majority of people realize the Pentagon is a bloated enterprise in every conceivable way, and that the massive investments that the states and the federal government have made in higher education really ever since the Civil War, and especially in the century and a half thereafter, were crucial in making this country a world leader in knowledge, in applied knowledge, in technology, in science, in medicine, and in much of the arts and the social sciences too, and that something has to be done about rebalancing those aspects, that we are simply creating an impossible rod for our backs economically with the amount of money we spend on the military, given how little it returns in terms of ideas and commodifiable practices, things and products and services by contrast with the universities. And also that, again, part of our military world is to take young men in particular, but also young women, away from higher education and into military service, when it would be much better if they were honing their skills and their innovations inside universities or other forms of higher ed. So I think that there's no doubt that that really needs to happen. In terms of the imperial presidency, both parties have sought over the last 30 years to restore the imperial presidency to the status that it had before Watergate and the rise of administrative law really tore down much of the authority that the presidency had. And I mean that in two ways. First of all, the notion of the president as almost above the law. And secondly, in terms of overseas ambitions, the desire to be an all-powerful hegemonic force, reassuring and buttressing U.S. economic interests around the world, but also operating for its own sake as an imperial power broker. It seems to me that we're facing a situation economically where that simply isn't sustainable. It cannot go on. And all the debates about the deficit and the debt that we have that orient themselves around cutting public programs do not really address the issue that some of the public programs, in particular educational ones, have a monumental return on investment. Most of the military programs do not. And many other much more productive, peaceful, and practical jobs could be found for people currently on the government coin in those areas if we were simply to think about, in a sense, moving away from this imperial presidency and instead turning towards a smart country.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Toby Miller. Toby, bye-bye.
Hi. Thanks, Ian.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Toby Miller, who is in London. He's a professor of cultural industries at the City University of London and recently the director of the UC Studies Center in Mexico City and chair of the Department of Media and Cultural Studies at the University of California, Riverside. Toby Miller is one of the world's leading analysts of popular culture, media, and their connection to the politics of everyday life. And his books include Cultural Citizenship, How Conservatives and Neoliberals Captured the Cultural Politics of Television and How We Can Take It Back, Greening the Media and Blow Up the Humanities. His latest article at the City University of London's website is The Race for the White House 2012, The New American Dream. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about another aspect of Mitt Romney that has been off limits, his role as a member of the Mormon royalty and his connections to the hierarchy of the Mormon Church.
You need it, that's for sure.